seconds and counting. We are go for Apollo 7 at this time.
Saw Joseph's first talk on bullion brains bonds and the financial, historical, and cultural analysis of the breakaway civilization. Very interesting, and I do believe that he's going to pick up from that trail and continue that story today. So a lot of good stuff to get to here, ladies and gentlemen. Our guest has a doctorate in patristics from the University of Oxford. He is also the author of many fascinating books in the field of alternative research, history, archaeology, science, and other strange stuff. His website, of course, is GizaDeathStar.com. And I think this presentation is going to be very interesting with focus on why UFOs show an extraordinary interest in our nuclear capabilities. Is this because this technology actually is a gateway to other capabilities? Today his talk will be on UFOs, the Tower of Babel moment, and space collateralization and commercialization, an analysis of worst-case scenario policy formation of the breakaway civilization. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's get to it. Joseph P. Farrell.
Thank you. All right, let's get started. I'll get the commercial out of the way. This talk is, again, based on several of my books, some of the more recent ones, but beginning with SS, Brotherhood of the Bell, Secrets of the Unified Field, The Nazi International, Saucers, Swastikas, and Psyops, Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, taking the phrase from our colleague Richard Dolan, and then Covert Wars and Clash of Civilizations, and then finally a kind of a neglected book in some of the series, Babylon's Banksters, all right? So what I want to do in this talk is talk about three main points that I think were signal events, crucial components in the policy formation culture of what Richard has been calling the breakaway civilization. And I love this term, and I'll be referencing it in a moment with reference to some of Richard's writings about this. But there's three points to my talk. I want to talk about the necessary background and context by which I think we have to understand the policy formation culture of the breakaway state. The second thing I want to draw attention to in particular, since Richard kind of set me up very nicely by the reference to Wilbert Smith in Canada and Dr. Robert Sarbacher, I want to talk about UFOs, nuclear weapons, and the inevitable threat assessment that's going to come out of this. Now, please understand my argument here. I am not saying or suggesting that I believe that all UFO activity must or should be interpreted as hostile or potentially hostile. I'm merely suggesting that some of the activity is at the very minimum provocative, and certainly would have been viewed that way if not been viewed as hostile by the national security establishment. The final thing I want to talk about is the Kardashev scale and what I call the Farrell corollaries and the Tower of Babel moment of history, because I do definitely believe that we are in it again. All right, let's remind ourselves from Richard Dolan's writings of what he said precisely about the breakaway civilization, because I think this is probably one of the most astute and apt summaries of the concept that you will find out there. Listen very carefully. If we also consider the possibility of covert breakthroughs in propulsion technology and the off-the-grid nature of the deep black world itself, we come to the possibility that we are dealing, in effect, with a breakaway civilization, one with loose connections at various points to the open civilization of humanity, but with great independence, secrecy, and a monopoly of certain key scientific secrets. The history of the Cold War showed that separate infrastructures could, to some extent, evolve. In principle, however, such a development is possible, and responsible research must consider the strength of supporting evidence and clues, unquote. And you'll find that quotation from Richard's volume, UFOs and the National Security State, the cover-up exposed 1973 to 1991. That's on pages 564 to 565. Now, I want to follow it up with another quotation, a very short one, also from the same book, or pardon me, from the earlier companion volume to this book by Richard Dolan. He said this, quote, UFOs constitute the great whole of contemporary history. We know, at the very least, that this was a topic of great concern to those at the top of the American national security policy, despite the near complete absence of public references to it, unquote. And as I put it yesterday, and as Secretary Fitz put it this morning, I think as you saw yesterday from Michael Schratz and Mark McCandlish's talks, this is indeed the great hole in the financial, cultural, political, and technological scientific story of our age. The question is why? What is all of this black budget system of finance? What is all of this hidden system of finance and the political infrastructures and counterintelligence operations for? So what I'm going to do in this talk, and I hope I'll be able to get through it very quickly so that Dr. Rosen has time to present. She's been waiting all day. So I'm going to attempt to present 6 points. And what I'm attempting to do is to reverse engineer one component of the breakaway civilization, national security structures, policy-making culture. And there's 6 points to this component. First of all, UFOs displayed an inordinate curiosity towards ours and the Soviet Union's thermonuclear weapons capabilities. Number two, this curiosity included an actual interference with those weapons systems. And it is this feature alone which would constitute the provocative action of UFOs that I believe contributes, especially in the Cold War context, contributes to this culture of secrecy and paranoia and the attempt, as Richard indicated and as I said yesterday, to emulate the technological performance capabilities of UFOs. Thirdly, this activity would have been and was interpreted by military authorities as a reconnaissance activity, and thus the UFO was interpreted as a threat, though most likely not an imminent one. And fourthly, this activity would have led the breakaway group or the national security establishment to question why the UFOs were so concerned with nuclear weapons. And the answer suggested or hinted at yesterday in my review of Dr. Ronald Richter's fusion project down there in Argentina was that thermonuclear weapons represented a gateway technology to the ability to manipulate the zero-point energy. And the significance of this fact, let me refresh your memory once again. Anytime you have a technology that is capable of engineering the fabric of space-time or the zero-point energy locally on the laboratory bench, you have, first of all, a technology that, if weaponized, would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. If you engineer it for propulsion purposes, then quite literally, the sky is the limit. And thirdly, as Richard intimated in his talk, This would mean a complete restructuring of the financial system is necessary. And as Catherine suggested this morning, they are in the process of erecting a new system. So the question is why? And I would submit that, following Richard Dolan's suggestion, that the reason is the UFO is the great hole in our contemporary culture, and particularly in our understanding of technological developments. So then, the fifth point. This would have led that national security structure to the conclusion that technological progress was not linear, but geometric. And thus, and this is an argument that you have to think about very carefully, and thus that humanity was not millennia or centuries behind whoever is behind the UFO, but perhaps mere decades. And I'll be presenting at the very end of this talk some very provocative and mind-boggling statements that have been issued lately by NASA and DARPA. Now, this would have initiated, as I suggested yesterday, a long-term mega Manhattan Project. Imagine the Manhattan Project on steroids, with not billions but trillions of dollars over decades to spend and research some of these technologies for the purposes of the technological emulation of the phenomenon. And then finally, this would have led to the realization, all of the previous points, would have led to the realization that humanity was in a danger period, a Tower of Babel moment of human history, during which non-terrestrial intervention prior to such human technological emulation in human affairs and independence had to be contemplated and prevented. And let's refresh ourselves for a moment about the Tower of Babel story in the Old Testament. Because you read the Old Testament, and any time there is an intervention by God or the gods, it's always in the context that whatever activity that humanity or the ancient Hebrews are engaged in, this is a sinful activity, and it has to be stopped and punished. But when you read the story of the Tower of Babel in chapter 11 of Genesis, something very unusual doesn't occur. And that is, there's no mention that humanity building this tower, which can reach unto heaven, is doing anything sinful. What does it say? And the Lord noticed that man was building this tower, which could reach unto heaven, and listen carefully, which if they completed, they would be able to do whatsoever they imagined to do. So in other words, even that text is suggesting very, very dimly that there's a technological aspect. Quit thinking in terms of Renaissance paintings of big towers built out of bricks reaching to heaven. What it's talking about is a physics that can manipulate the mechanics of heaven, that can manipulate the physics of gravity, that can manipulate the physics of zero-point energy. So this is an activity that had to be stopped. And the UFO and nuclear weapon question are intimately related, as we're going to see, to that proposition. Now, my argument is not that the breakaway group would hold such views and formulate such policies based upon these views to the exclusion of other analytical hypotheses, but merely given the military and intelligence culture that these views and analyses and policies are being formulated in, that they would have had to consider the potentiality of a threat and derive some sort of long-term research plan and response to the phenomenon. So it's a Tower of Babel moment. Now, I want to consider in this respect just a very few UFO incidents from the time period of the end of World War II up through the very early 60s that indicate provocative action on the part of UFOs, at least on the basis of the human interpreters of these actions. So let's begin with this. An anomaly. In July of 1965, our Mariner 4 Mars probe disappeared behind Mars. And as it disappeared, of course, it fell out of radio communications with the Earth. Now, of course, they can calculate the velocity and therefore the time that it will reemerge from behind Mars and reestablish communication with Earth. But 12 minutes passed before anything was heard from this satellite. And this is an incident reported by an old ufologist back in the 1960s, Frank Edwards, Flying Saucers, Here and Now, page 90. And they have no idea why this happened. We don't know if UFOs were involved or not. But then consider this. The Anna and Firefly Telstar communications satellites in October of 1962, the Firefly satellite went completely dead, and the U.S. Air Force assumed that for whatever reason, it was lost. But, unexpectedly, in August of 1963, it came back online. Now, certainly, they weren't pointing the fingers at the Russians, because the Russians didn't have that kind of go-get-it, grab-and-snab capability back then. Consider this incident, and this is a direct UFO incident. On October 19th of 1953, an American Airlines DC-6 departs Philadelphia for Washington, cruising altitude about 8,000 feet. The crew spots a UFO, which dives at the aircraft, forcing it to take emergency evasive action. The story ran once in the Washington Post morning edition. And again, this is Frank Edwards, Flying Saucers, Serious Business, page 43. Let's consider this one. On November 3rd and 4th, in a nighttime flight in 1957, a Brazilian Varig Airlines cargo flight from Porto Alegre to Sao Paulo sees a rapidly approaching UFO. The crew inside the plane smells something burning. And after the UFO departs, the radio, the aerial direction finder, and the right engine generator are burned out. So in other words, we have a signature of almost total electrical system failure. The aircraft has to turn around and returned to Porto Alegre. Again, in August 14th, 1957, another Varig Airlines C-47 cargo airliner. They spot a disc with a dome on top of it. The UFO flies close once again to the C-47. It causes the cabin lights to dim, the radio reception to go dead, and the engines to sputter. When the UFO departs, again, the electrical systems return to normal. And again, that's Frank Edwards. Now, why am I bothering you with all this? Well, it's because of this. If you total all this up, and there are many such incidents, these are some early ones on into the early period of what? Satellite technology. So we've got three things that they would be immediately concerned about. First of all, any space probes and space assets are potentially at risk. And secondly, and here's the important one for the financial elite, So in other words, when I told you yesterday that the Rockefeller family privately funded the backup camera system to the Corona spy satellites, this is why. Okay? The second problem is that the capability to interfere with satellite space-based communication systems, and hence the emerging electronic world of international financial clearing, which, as Secretary Fitz suggested this morning, is based upon those satellite assets, are ultimately going to be potentially at risk. And this is the system they're engaged in putting into place at this time. So in other words, the UFO constitutes a direct threat to their plans. And they'll study it for that reason alone. And then thirdly, obviously, civil passenger and cargo shipping by air are potentially at risk. Now, if this isn't enough to make you stop and consider that the national security apparatus is going to be tremendously concerned with the UFO problem, then let's look at this. Now, if you don't know this gentleman's work, I want to urge you to get it and study it. It's a very thoroughly researched, about 500-page volume. It's written by Robert Hastings. It's called UFOs and Nukes, Extraordinary Encounters at Nuclear Weapons Sites. And I'm going to be referencing his work in this part of my talk. In spring of 1966, at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana in Great Falls, a UFO is seen by base personnel hovering over various Minuteman ICBM missile silos on the base, and it shuts down a flight of 10 of those Minuteman ICBMs. Now, here's the interesting thing. If you think all of this is entirely beyond human capability, think again, because the Air Force hired the Boeing company to come in and examine what had happened. And Boeing was able to reproduce the effect remotely. In other words, understand what that means. That means that Boeing reproduced an effect able to shut down a flight of missiles without any direct physical contact. But if there's someone else flying in the skies able to do that, let your mind run with the possible implications of what that might mean in a thermonuclear age. Secondly, in November of 1975, a UFO is reported hovering over the missile silos once again at Malmstrom. And in this incident, it's alleged that the targeting data inside the missiles was altered. And again, this was done remotely. Now let's go to my home state. I love this one. Let's go to my home state of South Dakota, okay? In 1966 at Ellsworth Air Force Base, just outside of Rapid City, you can drive right by it on Interstate 90, UFOs were again reported around the Minuteman ICBM missile silos. And in this case, the power in these silos went completely down, and that included the backup power. And that meant that for that moment, that entire flight of ICBMs at Ellsworth Air Force Base was taken completely offline. Now, is that a national security threat to the U.S. Air Force? You betcha. And lest we think that they're concentrating on just the good old USA, in October 4th of 1982 at Bielokorovice in Ukraine, a UFO, just like in the United States, was seen hovering over Soviet ICBM silos. And this time, guess what? The launch sequence was activated. And the missiles began the countdown. And the Soviet crews were frantically trying to stop a thermonuclear war. Now, I don't know about you folks, but there is no way, there is no other way than to interpret that as provocative. It may not necessarily be hostile if you stop and think about it, but it's at least provocative. So let's ask ourselves the question. Why is it? Put yourselves again in the shoes of the national security analysts inside this breakaway civilization structure. Why is it that the hydrogen bomb wasn't classified as high as the UFO? Is there more than just a coincidental connection? Well, let's look at this. This was reported by Edward Ruppelt in his report on unidentified flying objects. And of course, he was one of the U.S. Air Force's officers tasked with the Air Force's official study of UFOs. And it's interesting that during the series of the first hydrogen bomb tests, the Ivy Mike tests in the South Pacific of 1952, Project Blue Book was activated to provide cover and analysis of any potential UFO activity at America's first hydrogen bomb test, Ivy Mike. Ruppelt states this, quote, "The crews of Navy and Air Force security forces who did go out to the tests were thoroughly briefed to look for UFOs, and they were given the procedures on how to track and report them. Back at Dayton, we stood by to make quick analysis of any reports that might come in. None came," unquote. So you might think, well, they missed the boat. Well, think again. This is where it gets interesting, folks. This is where we're going to have to do the high-octane speculation. This is where we're going to have to start connecting dots. Why is it the UFO is classed higher than the hydrogen bomb itself? The entire CASEL series of tests was monitored by UFO activity. And interestingly enough, CASEL Bravo and CASEL Coon were two very interesting tests because they had calculated the pre-test yield of the CASEL Bravo hydrogen bomb to fall between a range of 5 to 8 or 7 megatons. When they fired the thing off, it ran away to 15. Whoops. Now, part of the problem is that our thermonuclear engineers later came up with the explanation that some of the lithium deuteride that they had in the fuel mixture for the bomb was lithium-7. And they said, well, we simply didn't know that lithium-7 would enter the fusion chain reaction. Again, whoops. But now you'll see the reason why I mentioned, another reason why I mentioned Dr. Ronald Richter down in Argentina. Remember him? Because when he was talking to Juan Perón's nuclear physicist, a fellow by the name of Dr. José Balsero, he told Dr. Balsero that he's getting these fusion reactions out of lithium-7. And remember what he also said. He was getting them in a rotating plasma under electromagnetic stress using Lamour precession frequency and on and on and on. And he then indicated that it was his belief he was getting these reactions because the plasma functioned as a coupling mechanism or a coupled harmonic oscillator with the cellular structure of space. So in other words, he's telling you there's something going on in plasmas beyond nuclear fusion. And he was doing all of this at temperatures far below what standard thermonuclear chemistry at the time said was possible. In other words, he was talking about cold fusion. And the modern term for it is lattice-assisted nuclear reactions. That's how far ahead of his time he was. So Balsero said, well, sure, you can have thermonuclear reactions with lithium-7, but you have to do it at much higher temperatures. My point here, folks, is that this is common thermonuclear chemistry. It's known ahead of the Castle-Bravo test. So it's my suspicion that there was another energy source gating energy into the hydrogen bomb, and it was precisely what Dr. Richter said. For a brief moment, for whatever reason, there was a coupling that was established with the fabric of local space-time, and it gated energy for a brief moment into the reaction, and the reaction ran away. Not to mention the fact that our scientists said, well, whoops, we didn't know lithium-7 would do that. Now, there's a second problem in the Castle series of tests. Castle-Kuhn was another test in the Castle series of hydrogen bomb tests. It was designed by Edward Teller and his team at Lawrence Livermore. When Castle-Kuhn was detonated, it had a precalculated yield of about 5 to 7 megatons. When it was detonated, it fizzled and only achieved a reaction of a mere 900 kilotons. In other words, the bomb was considered a failure. And yet, it's designed by the very man and his team at Lawrence Livermore that have designed our hydrogen bombs. Why the failure? I suggest that one reason might be found in the high-octane speculation of the day. And I'm reading to you from my book, let me find it here, Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, and it's quite a lengthy quotation, and I'm going to try and race through this for you. If some of these UFOs are the product of an actual technology, and if this technology includes a field propulsion capability that is based upon the ability to manipulate or engineer the local fabric of space-time, then it stands to reason that this capability could be deliberately employed, here it comes, either to alter the yields of nuclear thermonuclear devices, either greatly magnifying them or greatly damping them, as is suggestively the case with the Castle-Kuhn test. The presence of UFOs throughout the Castle series of tests, plus the extraordinary inability of American engineers to calculate pre-test yields on the basis of standard thermonuclear chemistry, would indeed have made the UFO a priority matter for the national security state, if for no other reason than that these capabilities implied the ability to render the whole nuclear weapons enterprise so much useless hardware, or the converse, the ability to render it vastly more efficient than its designers intended. So, small wonder then that the matter was classified higher than the hydrogen bomb because it's directly related to it. It implies a physics of much more flexibility and destructiveness. Now, I believe, very definitely, as I say on the slide up here, I believe that it's this type of speculative reasoning, of a process of reverse engineering a phenomenon that they're encountering, that lies behind, at this very same moment of history, that lies behind the disappearance of anti-gravity as a subject of discussion in the open, popular, and technical journals at that time. Because there was a lot of it before this time period. But after these nuclear tests, it shuts down. This means that they had to determine the physics principles, which they did not know, that were operating. So now do some dot connecting with me. What's the sun? The sun, according to the standard model, is a big, huge, chained-up ball of plasma. It's a big, huge, chained-up hydrogen bomb. And what's it doing? Well, it's rotating, okay? And that plasma, incidentally, is rotating at different velocities at different points on the surface of the sun. The physicists call that differential rotation. So it's creating a bit of a twist as it rotates in the plasma. And all of this is also going on in a plasma that's under tremendous gravitational and electromagnetic stress, okay? And all of this somehow, according to Einstein, who's simply looking at the gravity aspects of it, all of this somehow creates a gravity well in the fabric of local space-time that keeps all the planets neatly and tidily in their orbits around the sun. So in other words, folks, you're living in a space warp. That's what you're living in. Now, let's talk about the Nazi bell. If you know the story, as I've been trying to outline it, what were they doing? Well, they were taking two counter-rotating cylinders into which they injected a plasma-inducing material. They rotated these cylinders mechanically counterclockwise and also electromagnetically counterclockwise. They induced the plasma state in the central core of this device, which was an anode, and the outer core a cathode, and then they pulsed that plasma with extremely high direct current electricity. So what do you got again? You've got plasma, counter-rotation, there's your differential rotation in the sun, counter-rotation, electromagnetic stress, same thing. Now let's look at a third thing. If you recall Mark McCandlish's lecture from yesterday morning, his alien reconstruction vehicle, what do you have? What did you have? You had a plasma material in a central core. You had two plates of capacitors and dielectrics under electromagnetic stress, and all of this was being what? Rotated. So there's three things now. There's a natural object and two examples of a hidden technology that we've heard about that have leaked out that are essentially employing the same principles as would have been evident in a hydrogen bomb set off within the gravity well of the sun. So this is going to lead them ultimately to the type of consideration of, well, just who are we dealing with that can do this, that can make all this happen? This is Dr. Nikolai Kardashev, famous Russian astrophysicist and astronomer. And in thinking about these types of questions, Kardashev formulated a classification system. You often hear Dr. Michio Kaku talking about the Kardashev system. Carl Sagan talked about the Kardashev system. He formulated three types of civilization based upon the energy requirements needed to sustain the civilization. Now, please understand, these are Kardashev. These are not the feral corollaries, okay? A type one civilization would have the energy requirements of the resources of an entire planet. A type two civilization would require the energy resources of an entire star. A type 3 civilization would require the energy resources of an entire galaxy. And of course, at each stage, you're implying a technology. Please catch on to this. You're implying a technology able to engineer systems on each of those three scales. And I hope you caught the distinction, because there's a difference between requiring the energy requirements of systems on those scales and the ability to engineer systems on those scales. Okay? Now, while I was researching for this presentation, I ran into this interesting book, and I decided to include it in case some of you are unaware of it. A book by Dr. Travis Taylor and Dr. Bob Bone. And you can see the title here, Alien Invasion, The Ultimate Survival Guide for the Ultimate Attack. Okay? So these scientists are, in other words, they're telling you this is the how-to manual in case ET ever comes down and decides to detonate more of our hydrogen bombs. Okay? And they redid Kardashev's classification scale. Whoops, I went one too far. There we go. They've divided it into 5 civilization types requiring the energy output of 10 to the 16th to 10 to the 26th power watts. And they say that this is roughly equivalent to the type of civilization that you see in Star Trek, the original version. A type 2 civilization, the energy requirements of 10 to the 26th to 10 to the 36th watts would be more Star Wars Galactic Empire. And it's interesting you see how they're trying to communicate the basic concepts that we've already been made aware of in our science fiction, television and film. A type 3 civilization would require the energy output of 10 to the 36 to 10 to the 46 watts, Stargates at Ancients, the ancient ones in the Stargate series. A type 4 civilization, 10 to the 46 to 10 to the 56 watts, Star Trek The Next Generation's Q, if you're familiar with that infamous character from that particular series. And then a type 5 civilization, 10 to the 56 to 10 to the 66 watts, Doctor Who, if you're a fan of that show, the Time Lords. But then they boil it down to some more scientific terms, and they give us a little equation here. V equals the warp factor times the speed of light, okay? To give you an idea of the types of technology that they're thinking about. A is the warp factor capability, C, of course, is the velocity of light, and then V is your ability to transit a system of a galactic scale. With A set to 0.1, your galactic transit time in the Milky Way galaxy would be, get this, 400,000 years if you had a partial basis of warp capability, basically where we're at now. If your warp capability is capable of 1 or the velocity of light, it's going to still take you 400,000 years to get across the Milky Way galaxy. But now if you have a warp capability of 100, it's only going to take you 4,000 years to get across the Milky Way galaxy. And you can see what they're talking about here. World ships. Well, we could get there, yeah, but we'd have to build these gigantic intergenerational ships that would be traveling for several generations to get to their destination. But now, once we start talking about warp, well, we can explore our local quadrant, to use the Star Trek expression. With a warp factor of 1,000, you would be able to traverse the galaxy in 400 years. They call these unstoppable quadrant colonists. And of course, with a warp factor of 1,000,000, then you'd have unstoppable galactic colonists. And with the almost unimaginable warp factor of 100 million, you could transit most everything in about a day. You'd be godlike. Now, here's the implication, I think, of what they're getting at. Nuclear weapons, as I've been outlining them, are therefore a gateway technology to these capabilities. It's not, therefore, the nuclear weapon as such that they may have been interested in, but rather, if we figure out what the implications of this physics are in terms of these kinds of abilities to take humanity off planet and begin serious exploration and colonization of space. Because, folks, chemical rockets just ain't gonna do the job. So it's that capability, plus the implied capability of, oh, what if they weaponize this stuff? And that's the same concern of the elites. We know we've been able, at this moment, right now, phys.org is reporting on experiments being done in Australia, being done at MIT, of temporal cloaking, removing little micro-events from the time stream. And what they're telling you, if you read between the lines, is, yeah, we're engineering what? The fabric of space-time locally on the laboratory bench. But remember something. Remember the man I mentioned yesterday, Gabriel Krohn, writing about all of this in his physics paper that wins him the Montefiore Prize in 1935 at the University of Liège in Belgium? He said the same thing. In 1935. And he said it in response to electrical anomalies that engineers were noticing in large networked electrical systems, particularly, interestingly enough, rotating ones. And what he's telling you, folks, what he's telling you is that these tensor equations of Albert Einstein can be brought right down here onto the laboratory bench to engineer electrical circuits with 1935 technology. He's telling you that even back then, they had a rudimentary capability to do this. Small wonder that it only takes $1,200 to rent a copy of one of his books from a corporate library. So let's go back to Kardashev. I believe that what this might imply, at least for some of the policy planners in this breakaway civilization, was that they might have been, if they were thinking in terms of Kardashev, that they were dealing with a civilization of a type 1 or type 2 capability. Because after all, if they were on the godlike end of that spectrum, that the doctors Taylor and Bone talked about in their book, then if they're at the godlike end of the capability, they probably wouldn't have been all that interested in human hydrogen bomb pop guns. Okay? But if they are closer to us in terms of a physics science, and a technology based upon that science, it would be of more concern to them because it would mean that we're entering into competition in some respect. So here's how I put it in Covert Wars and Clash of Civilizations. I'm going to read this again to you. The concern and activity of UFOs would have compelled the breakaway group and its scientists to take a second look at nuclear weapons, to evaluate and perceive them not as weapons in and of themselves, but as gateway technologies to much greater capabilities. These considerations would have brought upon the breakaway civilization a disturbing realization that the A-bomb and H-bomb heralded humanity's second entrance into the Tower of Babel moment of history. That dangerous period When it was on the verge of political and cultural and economic unity, and Richard stressed this in his talk, and more importantly, it was on the verge of the acquisition of cosmic technological capabilities. Now, for the breakaway civilization, this would have meant that a delaying action, inclusive of the possibility of psychological operations, would have to be waged, while a crash program was developed to find out exactly why nuclear weapons were of such concern to those behind the UFOs, and then to develop the technologies to emulate its performance and bring humanity to the point of parity or near parity before a repeat of the Tower of Babel moment occurred. So in other words, if you look at what I've just told you and combine it with what Michael Schratt told you yesterday and with what Mark McCandlish told you yesterday, with what Richard talked about, with what Catherine talked about, with what John talked about, if you look at what all of this means, they're not only going to create a hidden physics and a hidden technology, they're going to create the infrastructure to keep it suppressed and control everybody's thinking. And that means manipulating even the differences between a public consumption science and a hidden science. Remember Ben Rich. We have solved the equations. We found an error in the equations. And now we can take E.T. home from the head of the Lockheed Skunk Works. In other words, he's told you right there, there's a hidden physics that we know nothing about. And I think it begins back there in the 50s with the hydrogen bombs and the UFOs and their interests. So what are you going to do? How are you going to address this provocative activity and demonstrate capabilities that are beyond our type 1 or type 2 civilization reality? I mean, we're not there yet. We don't really, at this stage, believe it or not, require the energy consumption of an entire planet. We're not there yet. So how do you do it? Well, I'm going to suggest to you that the answer comes from the world of finance. That you leverage it. That you create the appearance of the capability to do so. In other words, that you engineer systems that are capable of manipulating systems of a planetary scale and of a stellar scale, like ionospheric heaters, HARP, High Altitude Auroral Research Project. Now, HARP, most of you know, is a big, and they're retiring it, incidentally, folks. That means they got something better now. HARP is this big phased antenna array at Gakona, Alaska. I think there's something like 48 of these phased radio antennas. Now, if you don't know what a phased radio antenna array is, a phased array is simply a plurality of radio antennas beaming out a signal in the same frequency, but at slightly different phase. In other words, the signal at this tower is begun at one time, and then the signal at this tower is begun a few parts of a second later, and the signal at this tower a few parts of a second later. And what this does is it shapes the interference pattern of the waves coming out from each of these towers, and that allows them to bend the wave, to target it, to focus it, to disperse it. And this was, of course, the same technology that they use in over-the-horizon radars, because they're bending the signal over the curvature of the Earth, okay? Incidentally, that's a World War II technology. Guess who came up with it? Now, by beaming enormous amounts of radio frequency energy into the ionosphere, you can raise and lower areas of pressure in the Earth's ionosphere. I said the Earth's ionosphere, not Alaska's ionosphere, not Japan's ionosphere, the Earth's ionosphere. This is a planetary system. So you can manipulate weather systems, which are also, if you think about them, a planetary system. They're a complex system of subsystems integrated with each other. But you can do something else. The ionosphere is the natural protective covering of the Earth. And it, with the magnetosphere, with the Earth's magnetic field, is also a complex ecosystem. So you can change the quality of the entire planetary magnetosphere with this. Now here's the punchline. NASA recently announced, you can find this article on phys.org, NASA recently announced that they had discovered that there was some sort of magnetic field equivalent of the equigravisphere between the Earth and the Moon, that place where gravity between the Earth and the Moon is equally attractive. Well, there's a similar thing between the magnetic field of the Sun and the magnetic field of the Earth, where they touch. And where they touch, interestingly enough, they described it in the literature as a kind of portal. I don't like using that word because it conjures all sorts of erroneous ideas. But there is a relationship between the Earth's magnetic field and that of the Sun. Now, in electrical terms, in very crude, basic electrical terms, this means that they form a circuit. This means they form a coupling, a coupled system. And therefore, it would possibly be possible to induce by means of that system a resonance effect in the Sun itself, using it as the load end of something you're doing with an ionospheric heater on Earth. Those are the ferrule corollaries. Those are the engineered, leveraged systems that you're creating to demonstrate a human capacity to manipulate systems on those scales, and if need be, for destructive purposes. Forget about hydrogen bombs, like I told you yesterday. They're a pop gun. And remember what I said. The Air Force has recently shut HAARP down. Got something better now. So let me round out my concluding remarks with this concerning these corollaries from Kardashev's classification system in the Tower of Babel moment of history. What are you going to do with all this? Well, I think the first problem, remember what I said yesterday, there sits Alfred Leiding at Wright-Patterson Air Base in Dayton, Ohio, German-American engineer. He knows all these Nazi paperclip scientists. He's looking at some of these UFO reports, and some of these reports look like this Nazi stuff, and he goes to these Nazis and he says, well, what about this? Yeah, we were doing some of that. So he comes up with the 47 intelligence collection memorandum and tells people, well, let's go out and find the Horton brothers. We need to know where they are and what they're doing. But remember what he also did. Besides the United States Air Force concluding that somebody out there in the world is developing complex, sophisticated, exotic technology and is not us, he also came to the conclusion that there were just simply too many UFO reports for them all to be accounted for on the basis of a hidden human technology and infrastructure. In other words, there was a production problem. It was too expensive, and we couldn't produce enough of it. So the first thing I think you're going to do is to attempt to solve this problem by increasing human production capability. Think 3D printing, which in my opinion probably comes out of the black world. It's been around for a while. They're pushing it now. But who got the idea for this? Why did it just all of a sudden appear? Secondly, I think you're going to establish both public and secret advanced propulsion projects and think tanks. And listen to this. I think it was Mark in his presentation Saturday morning that mentioned the Mexican physicist Miguel Alcubierre. Well, Miguel Alcubierre was the physicist that published the equations for warp drive in the Journal of Physics, I think it was, in 1998. It's a short little paper. He's got all of his mathematics there. But he says, well, this is possible. But remember what I said yesterday. It would have required the mass energy conversion of the planet Jupiter to create one of these space warps, giving you faster than light travel capability. But guess what? Dr. Harold Sunny White at NASA has said that the metric, in other words, the measure of space-time cells in Dr. Alcubierre's equations is too big. You don't need that big of a metric, and you can use a much smaller one within the feasibility of human capabilities. So he's now heading NASA's project to develop the very first experiments in the technology tree leading to warp drive. And DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, I like to call it the diabolically apocalyptic research projects agency. DARPA has come out and announced the goal that it wants the United States to be warp capable, Star Trek, in 100 years. And personally, I think they're possibly even overestimating the time. They're being conservative. What else are you going to do? And Richard Dolan put this point perfectly in his talk. You're going to establish a global mechanism of intellectual thought control. And part of it, absolutely, is going to include a monitoring of UFO groups, reports, events, to mine data, to see what people are talking about. Fifthly, you're going to establish public and secret programs to explore all relevant issues related to the UFO phenomenon, including, and this is a very important point, including religious and mythological investigations of old texts from a physics or scientific point of view. Again, the Tower of Babel. They're building a tower which can reach unto heaven. In other words, the ability to reach unto heaven is a physics that allows you to grasp the fabric of space-time, to have the godlike ability to manipulate the fabric of space-time. And if you do that, then you have the ability to put it as the Old Testament put it, to do whatsoever they imagine to do. Okay? And you're going to investigate all sorts of traditions of this nature around the world to see if perhaps they might contain a clue as to the motivations of these people, as to the possible science behind them, as to their thinking, and so on. Absolutely, you're going to do this. And that's going to include an examination of the weird. And thank you, Richard, for mentioning the weird, because I was debating whether or not to throw this in. But you're going to investigate the consciousness aspects of these phenomena, and that, unfortunately, is the subject of another talk in and of itself. So what do we end with? This is my last slide. We end where we began. You need lots of money. And as I indicated yesterday, with this fake bond from those bearer bond scandals where our government officials are confidently assuring us, no, no, these are all fake, no need to worry. Well, people don't counterfeit $7 bills. And the fact that it's coming with an association from an East Asian securities trading company with all of these little illusions, the moon, the space shuttle, the lunar excursion model on the back, suggests to me that this system that we've been describing in the last 2 days of hidden finance and fraud that was put into place at the end of World War II, they had to have something to offer the banksters to tempt them to participate in a scheme this vast and this illegal. That something had to make the risks worth it to them. So they secretly collateralized space. And that's it. Thank you.